Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP. Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 147 of Registry Matters. Larry, what's up with you?
Well, we're catching up with my age. We don't have that many more to go until we'll be up with me.
Not that many more? I'll throw this up on the screen for you. So I selected a photo of your, I think that's like your elementary school graduation photo.
Well, actually, it would be a sketch. We didn't have cameras back then.
How did you get everybody to stay still for so long to get a sketch of like 20, 30 kids?
It was not easy.
I wanted to share with you that I got a new little gadget for a production that I'm taking part in, and I have buttons that I can push and I can make things happen just on the cuff. Are you ready? So just pressing a button, I can make this happen.
That is why I am here.
And then I got this one.
I got my rights to do anything I want to do. I'm a police officer.
There, I could do it all. Anytime you're ready, man, I can do like, you people. I could do all those things just at the push of a button. I'm excited.
Fantastic.
All right, we have a truckload of stuff. We have an interview coming up later, and we have, 700 articles that you loaded us up. So it's going to be a chop, chop, chop show tonight. And I want to start with a question that you threw in here, and you may have slightly altered it. And so here we go. But
let's do it.
Are you ready?
Yep.
Okay. I'm so confused about the registry, and the more I listen to Registry Matters, the more confused I am. You people, keep insisting that there's no federal registry, yet everybody knows there is. What do you think the Drew Soden, I don't know how to pronounce that, website is? Is that not a federal registry? And the most ridiculous statement I've heard in my life is Larry keeps saying the registry is a non-punitive civil regulatory scheme. It's obvious he's either on the side of the system. Larry, are you like part of the system? Are you part of the man?
He figured.
Or is he too senile to understand jack shit about registration? Anyone knows that being forced to register is punishment.
Wow.
How about that? That's a lot going on there. So well, are you part of the system?
Yeah, he probably thought we wouldn't actually publish that. But it's Drew Soden. Now we'll see if the computer can spell that. We'll see what the computer does with it.
I got the Drew part. Could you say the last name again?
Soden.
Wow. Sjodin is what that is. Can I take a first crack at the website there? The website is just an aggregate list of all of the people that are on registries in the states. This doesn't indicate a federal registry. It's just like a meta search, let's call it.
Fantastic. And that is what that is correct of what that is. And if, for example, if you're registered in a state where they do not list your registration publicly, you will not be able to look in through the national website and find the person there, because it's only examination of what the state is revealing publicly. But when we say there's no federal registry, what we're talking about is there's no federal agency that registers individuals. There's no federal reporting. I've been challenging to find out if any state has a federal registry office. I'm not aware of any, but if there is, please let us know. But there's no federal registry in that sense. Now, there is the Drew Soden website, and there's a person file in the NCIC where those who are registered are entered by the registering entity. And that's the form of a national registry. But again, it's merely as if they had listed a warrant that's outstanding for you, there'd be a person file for that. Or if you had a concealed carry permit, they would enter you in the person file for that information. And there's a number of person files for missing people and we could go on and on. But it's
what about it's not from it, that point of view, anybody with a felony would be in that system too.
Potentially. So anybody who's ever had a warrant out, even though the warrant is served and they withdraw the warrant from active alert status, the fact the warrant was there is still there. But as far when we say there's no federal registry, what we mean is that there's no federal registration office to report to. And my personal assertion is that there isn't an independent federal duty to register, and that I'm not oblivious to what the court just recently said in the Wilman case. It doesn't change my opinion one iota. But but there is no federal registry. That's what we're talking about. Couldn't
we point to some sort of specific U.S. code, whatever it would be called? I mean, couldn't we point to something like that to say this is the code that says here's the federal registry, if there were one?
Well, we could, and there is, and that's what the listener is talking about. There is the Adam Walsh Act. There was the federal statute, but it's largely a plethora of recommendations to the states. Please do these things so that we'll have a more uniform, a more cohesive, a more workable system of registration. They did not create a federal registry, and they knew that there wasn't really jurisdiction to do that. Now, the current administration is actually trying to make it easier for there to be more reach in by the feds. And I'm very terrified. I think terrified might be too strong. I'm very concerned about what may happen once these regulations are adopted after the comment period. I believe that many states will pass very vague laws that say that a person cannot be removed if it would be inconsistent with federal SORNA, which is the Adam Walsh Act. And I would be very concerned about that, because then the states that have petitions for removal, that would empower the judge to deny the petition if that person would have had a longer obligation under federal law. So if you're in Arkansas and after 15 years, you go to your local circuit court that convicted you and you file a petition, and if Arkansas doesn't do anything other than saying that you can be removed if you meet the following criteria, and then they add one more sentence that says, or unless it would be contrary to the term of registration as suggested or as required by however they word it by the Adam Walsh Act, then all of a sudden you've got a new ballgame.
And something else in there says, the most ridiculous statement I've heard in my life is that the registry is non-punitive civil regulatory scheme. Okay, so you go to the office and you do your registration, and that's the end of the equation. Is that a problem?
Well, the reason why we say that, because that's what the courts have said when they've examined the requirement, because the mere act of requiring a registration for something doesn't translate magically to it being punishment. And we've said over and over again that young men between 18 and 26 are required to register for the draft. They don't get a choice. They're required to do that. There is absolutely nothing punitive about the requirement. It is in order so that we have current information to contact the young men. That only applies to young men between 18 and 26. And it's made very easy for them to register and to keep their registration current. And if they don't do it, they're subject to possible 5 years of federal imprisonment, and they lose student aid and all sorts of benefits of citizenship. But no one has ever argued that the mere act of registering for the draft is punitive. The mere act of being required to register in and of itself isn't punitive. So therefore, each time there's a concern about registration, the challenging party has to show that registration scheme, not the generic idea of registering, but that particular registration requirement has so many disabilities and restraints that it is punitive. And that,
which would be potentially living restrictions, any sort of driving logs, which would be presence restrictions, things of that nature.
Yes, like if you look at the decisions that where things have gone favorably, and you look at the decisions where things have not gone so well, the jurisdictions that have more restrictions and more disabilities and restraints have more difficulty with the challenges. They lose those challenges. Recently, in the Millard versus Camper, which was originally Millard versus Rankin, there just weren't enough disabilities or restraints in Colorado, and it certainly did not rise to the level of being cruel and unusual punishment. And in fact, they found that there had been no previous decision finding the Colorado registry to be punitive, which was the step one before you get to cruel and unusual. But I understand registration probably as well as anybody out there. And no, I'm not a part of the system, but I recognize what we can do in the courts and what we can't do. And what we have to do in the courts is we have to bring challenges where clearly the registration has gone past what can be reasonably construed as civil regulatory. And we have to be prepared to finance these challenges so that there's an adequate evidentiary record built, which there wasn't in Colorado. The lawyer did not have the money to build a record, and she was thankful that the judge didn't want a lot of evidence. But those things are important because the burden is on you, the challenger. The law is presumed constitutional, and that's what we've been hammering for almost 3 years we've been doing this program.
And I really want to highlight the senile and jack shit part.
Well, senile, I'm not sure I've heard had anybody say that before, but are you... the jack shit part, I'm kind of recognized as an expert, so I don't know where that comes from, but that's an opinion, I suppose.
So let me tell you, about 3-ish years ago, I was going through my Rolodex, and I was like, I was under the jack shit folder and saying, okay, who knows the least about Larry! And I picked you because you're the guy that knows the least about this stuff.
So,
and that's how we got started, because you are the most ignorant on the subject, for sure.
I appreciate that.
Yep, and that's why we keep having you back week after week, because we're trying to learn you about the whole registration thing.
That's really, really, I really appreciate that.
And finally, anyone knows that being forced to register is punishment. But like you said, the act of registration, you know, we always use Vermont, and I'm sorry, Vermont. So you send in your little postcard every year, whatever the hell it is, as far as what their requirements are. But it's all the other baggage, the North Carolina, the Packingham of having internet restrictions, having to release all of your internet identifiers, having relationship kind of restrictions, like all of that stuff is where Paul highlighted it. He's a terms to always use, disabilities and restraints. It's an incredibly powerful combination of words is to say disabilities and restraints. I think that really sums it up incredibly concisely to describe what we're talking about.
And to me, of the seven factors, that is the most important of those Kennedy Mendoza Martinez seven factors in terms of the analysis of the court. You need to build a case around the disabilities and restraints. Throw your recidivism in the dumpster, because that will not win your case. Because they try and they cock their head every way that they can to argue that, and it does not work. But if you actually show how you're disabled and restrained, you have a lot better chance of success.
And to word that, I guess to try and go the other direction, where even if the recidivism rate were incredibly high, it could still be unconstitutional. The disabilities and restraints, those could still be shown to be true, and it would be struck down. We just try to use it to make people feel less afraid, I suppose, is where that's coming from. And can you toss out your machine gun analogy?
Well, they obsess over it because it was in the Supreme Court's dicta. And they think that that's the reason why the Supreme Court made the decision they did in 2003. And they did not make the decision because of that. They made the decision because there weren't any disabilities or restraints. And they said that repeatedly in the Smith versus Doe decision. But somehow or another, people focus on dicta rather than what they actually said in their findings. And they worry about that. And the Supreme Court was handed that as a fact from below because the parties had agreed that since they didn't do it through a trial, they did it through summary judgment. The opposing party, the defending party, they were entitled to have their facts believed that they said we would have put on had there been a trial. And for some reason, that goes over even the legal professional's head, that if you do summary judgment, everything that you would have asserted as a defense is presumed true. The court doesn't get to select what they want to believe. You have conceded that that defense is valid. When you say there's no material facts in dispute, you have acknowledged that they would have been able to prove that recidivism was high.
We probably need to spend like a good portion of an episode talking about that again, of how did we get there with summary judgment and all that stuff. And so we'll put that on the agenda for some episode where we can go into that in more detail.
That would be a lot of fun, and maybe we could have Paul come in, because I'm sure we see similarly, but there might be some difference that we're talking about. Paul Dubling from Chapel Hill.
I would love to have him on.
So,
all right. Well, then we will start moving on and knock these things out, because we are already like 38 minutes in, which you don't know that yet, because I'm time traveling. There's going to be another segment spliced in here somewhere. But at the moment, it's 38 minutes, but that's not what it's going to be on your timer right now. See how I'm doing time travel right now, Larry?
Fantastic.
All right. From triblive.com, Norman Reimer, AG candidates must discuss fixing trial penalty. I think what you are going after here is so you you get offered a plea deal of, like I described, I think just last week, my roommate had offered a 3-to-1 for some kind of killing of his wife, ex-wife, and ended up getting life in prison without parole. What is this case about?
Well, this is a case that's in the federal system, and it was decided just the 28th of September, so just a few days ago, where a person had asserted that they were subjected to a trial penalty. And that is a reality of life. And there, you can cock your head all you want to, there will always be a trial penalty, that we will never be able to stop a trial penalty. And there I go again, doom and gloom, right?
Yeah, I mean, I really didn't intend to bring you on the show every week for 147 episodes just so you could be doom and gloom. Can you give us something positive?
Well, the reason why you can't eliminate a trial penalty is because plea agreements stop the judge from being able to do things that they can do at the end of a trial. When you go to trial, whatever the accumulated exposure is for the crimes that you're convicted of, if you get convicted of 3 counts, and each one of those counts carry a maximum of 10 years, you've got 30 years of exposure. Therefore, nothing precludes the court from imposing the 30 years. If you do a plea agreement, you have the court is restricted, because hopefully your lawyer agrees, forces the prosecution to agree to a cap on sentencing. And sometimes that's not possible, but sometimes you achieve the same result by reducing the number of counts, which reduces the exposure. If they have 3 counts and they agree to drop 2 of them in exchange for the plea and do an open-ended sentencing, that's where the judge can sentence, then all of a sudden, let's say there were 3 charges that carried up to 10 years each, you've cut your exposure down to a maximum of 10 years. So therefore, you don't have the potential for the court to impose 30 years. This case is about a person who decided to go to trial because she wasn't going to take no plea for what she was accused of bilking Medicare and Medicaid, health care provider. She was in a conspiracy. And one of the conspirators tried to commit suicide and became incapacitated, and they weren't able to continue the prosecution. They made plea deals with the other two, and this is the case of United States versus Daniela Gozes-Wagner from the Fifth Circuit, case number 19-20157. And she decided that she was going to go to trial. Well, what her attorney probably didn't do, I can't say for sure, but I'm guessing they didn't do what I would have done, as I would have told her, because the original case, it was under the Obama administration. But when she didn't plead, she was indicted again in 17. Now, guess what happened in 2016? Do you have any recollection?
They changed the executive.
And that led to a new head of the Department of Justice named Jeff Sessions. And Jeff Sessions gave an order early on in his tenure to the Assistant U.S. Attorney Generals around the country to seek maximum counts, to stack as many counts as you could of prosecution, because this was the law and order president coming in. And
I'm in favor of this, Larry.
And he also said seek any type of enhancements you can. So this administration, they filed a superseding indictment in 2017. And they added charges. She was originally just charged with 1 count. So they filed a superseding indictment. They gave her 2 counts of conspiracy to commit health care fraud. And they added a conspiracy to commit money laundering. So all of a sudden, she had a whole lot more exposure because she didn't plead. So her argument was that she siphoned off the least money of the conspirators, but yet she got the most time. And she said
the other ones took plea deals.
Correct. And the Fifth Circuit said, nope, doesn't work that way. Because you, although you went to trial and the trial judge mentioned several times in the proceeding that she had exercised her right to go to trial. But they found out that despite going to trial, that he sentenced well below the exposure that she had based on the counts that she got convicted, and she chose to expose herself to those extra counts by not pleading. Nothing stops the government from filing additional counts against you. if they have anything that remotely resembles evidence, it will support those. And in this case, they apparently had enough to convince the jury because the jury was only out 3 hours. And I was saying what I would have told a person is, if we had a case that was pending in 2016, I would have said, well, you know, we're about to have a presidential election and elections have consequences. Now, this candidate is running on a law and order platform, which says that we need to protect society from bad guys. And if they win, it may be that we don't get the deal that they're offering now offered to us again. And you need to take that into consideration when you're deciding whether to reject the plea. Now, I'm not telling you have to plead because you're going to be the one who does the time. But if looking at this voluminous amount of evidence, and I can tell you with a fraud case like this, there would have been so much evidence. They would have had they would have had tons of it. You wouldn't have been able to put it in document form. They would have gotten it. They would have gotten it on what do you call the thumb drives. They would have gotten the reams of evidence. And based on what I would dare say, they can go through this and they can probably dig up another count or two on you. And if they do that, that changes the equation in terms of how much exposure you're going to have. And you need to take that into your thought process before you let this administration leave office. But the average criminal isn't going to think about that. They're not going to think about politics because I hate politics. It's disgusting to talk about politics. And all that does is just get on my nerves. But those things that get on your nerves may have a direct impact on your life. In this case, it had a direct impact on her life because she got 20 years. She got two 10-year sentences stacked consecutively. And the Fifth Circuit said, nope, no problem here. They sentenced below the guidelines, and the guidelines the guidelines are what Congress has decided would be appropriate sentencing for particular crimes. This exposure was not decided by the judge. This was what you decided when you elected your members of Congress that the proper penalty range would be for this crime, the severity level. You decided all that. The judge didn't.
Is there anything else before we move on?
I just think that we need to, our listeners need to take into account that when we're talking about who holds the office of president when it comes to federal crimes, there can be a significant impact on how the office of the attorney, U.S. Attorney's offices operate in terms of what they're doing. We give them credit for the First Step Act, although it wasn't their initiative. They did sign it. They helped bring it to the finish line in a watered-down fashion. They're also imposing some very harsh sentencing, and we don't need to lose sight of that. And that's what I brought this article in for.
Gotcha. From here, we're going to move over to an article from Politico that is making a phone call from behind bars. Shouldn't send your family into debt. We also have another article talking about something similar from Courant.com. But this one is... you're going to give credit to the current administration talking about this one, I believe.
I am indeed.
How weird.
I know, for all the criticism we get, but we try to give credit where credit is due. To set this up, the previous administration at the federal level, now we may need to dive in just a little bit, calls that originate and terminate within a state, those are referred to as intrastate calls, and those have generally been regulated at the state level. Calls that originate and terminate outside of state, those are interstate calls, and those are within the purview of the FCC. Well, that runaway previous administration, they decided that they thought they could regulate all phone calls, and they put forth a regulation that would have regulated and capped calls at 4 cents a minute, I think that were intrastate, and 5 cents interstate. And the phone companies challenged that in court, and they took it on appeal to the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, and they won. And this is finally years later, the current administration has decided that they've put forth a proposed regulation to reduce the price of calls dramatically. I think it said 44%. And there are some who think it should be even lower than that, but I'll take whatever I can get. I'm an incrementalist. If this administration recognizes that the cost of staying in touch with a loved one it's too expensive, and they're willing to cut it almost in half. I'll take it. What about you?
Definitely. I just have always really struggled with the idea that, you know, you're in prison. This is the start of your rehabilitation, blah, blah, blah. Oh, we're going to gouge the crap out of you for Christmas packages, having stuff sent from home, you know, or phone calls, and they're going to make it incredibly impossible for you to keep in touch with people on the outside. And we're going to, and I mean, it doesn't cost you the inmate money. It costs your family. Generally, I know people can, some places can put money on their phone cards or whatever, but generally it goes to the individuals on the outside to support this. And that's what this goes to, is people having to spend a mountain of money to try and keep in touch with their people on the inside.
Well, we've talked about this through the history of the program, and the flip side of that is that prisons are the most difficult thing to fund, because of all the things that are competing for funding. When you run for office, try going out talking to one of your legislators that's running for re-election and say, I really want you to put a lot of emphasis on increasing the funding for the corrections department, and tell me how well that goes for you, and it just doesn't. Of all the glitzy things that governments do, funding prisons just doesn't have a built-in constituency. So they're faced with trying to figure out creative ways to get money. And these phone companies, as technology advanced, figured out that they could provide an immense amount of security for institutions in terms of monitoring what people were talking about. And they offered these services, and then they offered a kickback, a percentage of the revenue to the prisons.
Right.
And that's very tempting, because when you're looking at funding your prisons, if you can bring in 1 or 2% a year from phone, that's an offset that you can put into education or something that's far more popular than funding people. The taxpayers just do not like funding prisons. They think the people broke the law, and they need the bare minimum necessary, and we don't need to be spending a whole bunch of money making mollycoddling those people. And let's see if it can spell mollycoddle.
And in this particular article from Politico, it's a good start, is the little subheading. It says, under pressure from families and advocates of people in prison, Congress has been weighing legislation that would be a good first step in addressing the problem. In March, the following of the work of Senator Tammy Duckworth and Representative Bobby Rush introduced the Martha Wright Prison Phone Justice Act, which was included in the nearly $3.5 trillion Heroes Act. Now, so who are the two people that were sponsoring the bill there, Larry?
Well, they are Democrats, but apparently this is something that has gained some bipartisan support, according to the article. But yes, those are Democrats that have pushed that. And the Heroes Act is a piece of legislation that's passed the House in late May, and the Republican Senate has refused to consider it. In addition, they're refusing to consider a most recent scaled-down version of the Heroes Act, which cut about a little over $1 trillion off of the price tag, and they're not considering that either. But that's a topic for another day.
Yes, I understand. I was setting you up to let you go on a little rant for a minute. What else should we know about this particular segment?
Well, we're just giving credit for the Trump administration for at least the FCC commissioners recognizing that this is a serious problem, and it goes contrary to stated policy of the Federal Bureau of Prisons to keep loved ones in contact, because it's the best thing to improve the odds of success, and a 44% reduction is a good thing.
Very well. We have an article over at USA Today. It says, police should not create crime. We have talked about this on a number of occasions of how do you move someone, how does something become actually entrapment of a cop, like dangling the baggie of weed in front of you or something like that. Is that entrapment? Somewhere in there that the line gets crossed of them staging something, from them enticing, to where it actually becomes criminal activity. And this is a whole article that describes a scenario of almost like a ring of people that got trapped into being drug dealers all of a sudden, and it was all set up by the government, by the law enforcement agencies.
It was an officer pretending to be a student and dealing with these challenge. I don't know how the politically correct term, but some of these students that are not help me out here. But they, I don't know if it was autistic or what, but anyway, they
were saying they were special needs kids. Yes. So they didn't necessarily specify how. So
yeah, they took advantage of this. But when we talk about this, the reason why this happens is because the police have excess funding. And those of you who hear that term defund the police, please get it out of your vocabulary. No one is talking about defunding the police in their entirety. What we're talking about is reducing some of the excessive funding that would make the police agencies have to pick and choose and prioritize what they can do. This looks like, if this story is remotely accurate, this does look like entrapment. This kid had no intention until the officer named Dan, that was supposedly a fellow student, asked him how to get a hold of some drugs. And that is a classic entrapment. If the person's predisposed and they approach the officer trying to find drugs, but the way it was presented is the officer approached the kid.
Which is almost how we've covered stories on the PFR side of the house, where someone goes on to an adult-oriented place to maybe find a date, whatever, and they talk to somebody who is of age at the time, who's actually a cop anyway, and then all of a sudden at the end, like, oh, wait, no, I'm 10 years old, I'm 13, I'm 14 years old, and then the situation changes, and then they still go meet the person. Had they cut off conversation at that point, then nothing would have transpired further, but they went to the meeting, but then there's still no kids, so who's the victim?
Well, it's...
I know that's not what this article is about, but...
It's similar because, like I say, these are allocation of resources that if we took our responsibility and we towed the conservative line, which is to look at each agency's funding and make them justify it, we would have better oversight in terms of how they're allocating the resources. And we would say, wait a minute, you're actually putting resources in this area and you're looking for crime. You're a solution in search of a problem. We need to pare back your funding. But if you ever talk about reducing a dollar worth of funding to law enforcement, somehow or another, you want to defund the police and you want to turn loose a tidal wave of anarchy. And that's the way that they've cast it. If you mention about anything about cutting funding for police, you're against the police.
Same as if you say this something like that about military. I was having a conversation, this is maybe a month or so ago, right, you know, when the defunding the police really started hitting a crescendo of its conversations. And he's one of our people, so he's a PFR, and he was like, oh, you can't take away one red cent from the police, because, like, look at how safe the streets are. He was just going on and on and on. And anything, if you want to do anything, you would have to just completely increase funding to add into this other agency's. He wants cops to go there full lock, stock, and barrel, all of the protective equipment, and de-escalate situations like RoboCop would.
So, well, that's tragic, because if conservatism really had any consistency and intellectual honesty, that would be exactly what you would do. You would look at every aspect of spending across the board and look for ways to work more efficiently, to innovate new ways of doing things. And if there's things that could be removed out of police hands that could be done more efficiently, you would be all for that. That's the true basis of conservatism. My friend, well, he wasn't my friend, but someone I admired in Texas, Ray Farabee, he used to espouse that. He was a conservative Democrat. And he said, but if we're going to be conservative and intellectually honest, we need to look at all aspects of spending and not have our sacred cows. The conservatives have their sacred cows, and they're not intellectually honest. And that's what really disturbs me. If we're going to be efficient about the use of taxpayer resources, let's look at all spending with a critical eye.
Shouldn't we then have, like, privatized police departments then? Because they would do it better, wouldn't they?
Well, no, I don't think that they would magically flip-flop on that one.
I know. I was like, oh man, we should have privatized police departments. We could get up. Who's the Dick Cheney's group that was that Blackwater? Who was, like, the militia group that was being funded, like, by the CIA or whatever?
Yeah, I think it might have been. That's too long ago.
Yeah, it was a while ago. Okay, so then this one you're, like, punting to give to me is from Vox. It says, the truth about violent crime in American cities explained in 11 charts. And anything with math, Larry, you kick over into my camp. This is a piece that with in a whole lot of gory detail, with all kinds of charts and graphs and descriptions, talks about how crime is the lowest it has ever been in forever. But it also, you know, there's a couple aberrations that since we've been on, since the whole COVID, the human malware has started, that there are specific areas where there have been upticks. But did you want to, like, try and cover anything in specific, or do you just want me to ramble for 5 minutes?
You can ramble for a couple of minutes. I was fascinated by what I could understand, but I've been saying this for so long that I'm I don't know what else to say, because people believe that crime is increasing, but the trends are just not there. I mean, you look at those charts way down there, the header, people believe crime is increasing despite a long-term drop. And you look at the crime rates, which is what I presented at the NARSL conference some years ago, when we almost had a suicide on the spot.
Someone almost like spit on your shoe on the spot.
I should say a homicide rather than a suicide.
Yes, he was going to come after you. But so in specific areas, there has been an uptick. I think it's even in this article that when talking about Portland, where like there was a whole, like the number of protests that were happening after George Floyd, I want to say the number was 1,500. And out of that, it was in the single digits where things had gone violent. And then when they threw in the feds, then everything escalated, oddly enough. But then with everybody at home, all kinds of property crime, all of like the whole range of crimes, except for things that would be occurring at home, some kind of domestic abuse, those kinds of crimes have gone up. Obviously, if you put a bunch of people at home together, they're going to get irritated. And maybe they start punching at each other. That doesn't seem like unusual to me or unreasonable to think that, Larry, if you and I spend a lot of time in the same hotel room, we're going to fight eventually. I'm just saying.
No.
Commercial burglaries are up, I guess, recently since protests. So there was like looting and stuff, but other like in general, crime and that whole trend line is just on a steady decrease, probably because of things like technology with like more cameras and surveillance. That's probably one of the primary drivers of it.
Did I lose you?
Are you still with me?
I thought I lost you.
I just had stopped for a moment. For Vox, they don't normally like cover things this long. This is a pretty, pretty long article with a million graphs. So I guess it's, I'd say 11, but there's a lot.
Well, I hope our listeners and our prison population won't be able to see this. That's too bad. We got to figure out a way to provide this to the prisoners.
We could probably get in trouble for that then, because that would be like no reproduction authorized, blah, 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 something like that.
So,
but it's good stuff. I like Vox a lot.
So thank you for putting that on the agenda.
I think that was still you. This next one comes from Law 360. In email attorney-client privileges, battle House sides with inmates. This is disturbing to me that when you have a letter sent to you in prison, Larry, from a law office, you get called up to the mailroom, they open it in your presence, they dump it out to make sure there's no contraband, they like maybe open up the letter just to make sure there's nothing attached to it. They fold the thing back up, they put it back in the envelope, and off you go. So they've just checked it for contraband. The same thing should exist for electronic communications, and since we've had the human malware, the coronavirus, there isn't a lot of attorney visits inside of prisons and jails. The only thing that they could then rely on would be email, and that is being watched just like email to your Aunt Rose and your Uncle John and whatnot. That seems disturbing to me, and you working in the defense side of the house, that would probably bother you greatly.
It does, and it pleases me greatly to see some bipartisan support on this, where there's a resolution in the House of Representatives to deal with that, and we've got Representatives Hakeem Jeffries from New York and Doug Collins from Georgia, and that crosses the political spectrum. Jeffries is a Democrat and Collins is a Republican, and they both recognize the significance of this attorney-client privilege, and that the corrections the law enforcement established but should not be reviewing what the attorney is talking to with their client, and that's a good thing.
This is, you know, we've been covering like the phone call thing. Once we put somebody to be a ward of the state, there are costs that are associated with that. And it would be, you know, the inmate can't do it themselves. They probably could if they, you know, like start doing some extracurricular activities to make some money, and you can set up your own communication channels. But otherwise, you need the state to provide you with effective, secure communications to talk to your attorney so that you can get proper representation.
That is correct. And like I say, this is something that bothers me greatly, and I'm glad to see the bipartisan corporation it's a rarity these days, but apparently that this has something that's understood by both sides of the aisle. Hopefully it'll make it through the Senate, and hopefully it'll make it to the president. And I know that the president would sign it.
The piece in here that I didn't even really consider, that something that you probably would have, was once you're gone, prisons hold on to your email. And in the case of communications with your attorney, that stuff should be scrubbed and purged. You know, if you have your own legal letters, you put them in a manila envelope and you walk out the gate. But what do you do with the digital stuff? How would you take that home with you?
So
that would be challenging, Larry.
That's something I had never thought of.
Me neither. Over at the crime report, why redefining violence should be a justice priority. This is a neat kind of obscure article of how you would take the term being a violent offender of some kind. And this doesn't just relate to PFRs, but if you're the driver of the getaway car and they go in and commit some really nasty burglary, you know, bank robbery, whatever, and those people are listed as violent offenders, that you could be sucked into that too, even though you only drove the getaway car. It's interesting. I'm really big on terms, that if you mean this term, please use that term. Because it's really important for us to be able to communicate effectively, and forgive me for using big words, but they're more juicy. And so using the term violent, if you didn't commit something that was like a kidnapping, and I mean legit, like cuffing somebody or putting, you know, tying them up and manhandling them around, why do we use the term violent if it's not actually violent?
Well, you're going to get me off on a tangent. I think it has a lot to do with the victims' advocates. I remember a show from Bill O'Reilly many years ago when he was debating a person who was talking about PFRs, and that it was a woman. I guess it was a spouse or a mother of a person who had been convicted of a sexual crime. And Riley gave her a few seconds to say her piece, but then he said, "Ma'am, I hate to tell you, but all sex crimes are violent, and all sex crimes are not violent."
Right.
Unless you have a really distorted view of what violence is. And it's so sad because it's not only in the area of sex crimes, but in other areas of criminal justice where they label something violent and there's actually no violence. And it causes the security designation to change, the amount of privileges and opportunities they have to be altered by having a label of violence. And we don't really consider all the ramifications of that when we just stamp violent crime on a list of offenses. Well, that's a crime of violence. Well, let's make sure that it actually is a crime of violence, and let's make sure we agree on what violence is. And that's really hard with the victims' advocates because they want everything to be violent.
They certainly do. So, I mean, like, you know, a felony jaywalking, damn it, that's a violent crime because you could have made a person driving their car with a kid in the back. They could have swerved, and now you've harmed the child. So, yes, felony jaywalking could be a violent crime.
Well, I mean, the domestic violence would be a better example than that. Well, there's some significant violence that happens where people do some bad things.
Of course.
But also domestic violence, even though they call it domestic violence, there's domestic violence which really doesn't include any violence. Domestic violence could be interfering with communications, you know, with a domestic partner. You haven't done anything violent. There's no black eyes. There's no dishes across the forehead. There's nothing like that. But you've committed domestic abuse, and therefore you've been deemed violent, but you haven't done any violence. You pull the plug on the cell phone or the landline, and you, they can't call out. But is that violent?
You may have prevented them from summoning help.
You hold the scarf up, and you make a little knot, and you say, if you don't do what I want you to do, mm-hmm. and you jiggle that thing, have you done any violence?
But you've like,
you may have caused a person.
You've attempted to. You've attempted to coerce.
But you haven't even done that. You've made the person believe that there's a potential.
Correct.
But you haven't inflicted any violence yet.
I understand. I'm with you.
So do we label that person violent? I don't know. That's where the debate comes in. Well, they could have taken that scarf and put it around the. Yes, they could have, but they didn't.
They could have also taken the pencil in the junk drawer and stabbed you in the neck, but they didn't do that either. Do you label that as the violent person just because the potential is there?
So, yeah, but that's a biggie for me. I'd like for us to define violence better and not label things so freely violent where there hasn't been any violence.
Very good.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
And this is from Vice News. The only witness who heard police announce themselves at Breonna Taylor's door changed his story. You're going to fire everybody up with talking about Breonna Taylor, Larry.
I am, but it's consistent with what happens when you change your story. People try to undo their pleas and say that when they told the judge that the factual basis existed, that they should be allowed to change that. That when a witness comes forward and says, I want to change my story now, I'm recanting that I said the person did that, then that person is no longer deemed credible. If a key witness in the investigation of Breonna Taylor's death has changed their story to be intellectually consistent and honest, we would no longer deem that person a credible witness in any way, shape, or form.
And that
if
don't you have to evaluate the state of the individual when they made the first statement? Maybe they were under some kind of duress or hadn't quite processed everything prior, you know, at the first interview versus the second. I mean, isn't there a way to figure out which story would be the accurate one?
Well, I suppose if you want to stretch that far, but this is where the police said that they announced themselves or not. How would you be able to be inconsistent on that story? Either you heard the police say police or you didn't hear. How could you have a recollection later that they did or didn't? How would that? It's like Scalia said about 18 was 18, then it's 18 now. They either said police or they didn't. How could you have an epiphany and say that they didn't announce themselves after you had previously said that they did? You're no longer credible.
With the research that I have done about memory and how it works, you could have not heard it and it be there, and just because of the overload of sensory stuff at the time and then reprocessing it. Now, I don't know if you would then actually remember them hearing it, or did you insert the memory? I am so sketchy on that particular subject that I don't really believe much of what anybody's memory is per se, because it's so subjective to your particular situation at the time, whether you're sleepy, whether you have some extra caffeine, and then, you know, how has your life transpired up to that point? It's so subjective that I really don't put a lot of stock in what people's memory is to begin with. But this is the only eyewitness to say whether they did or didn't say police when they knocked on the door originally.
Yeah, well, it's troubling now because this is such an important, significant case. And whether the police announced themselves is critical in terms of the actions that they took. It would be very reasonable for a homeowner to start shooting if they didn't know that they were police. It would be very, very reasonable. And everybody on the law and order side of the aisle should be applauding that. That's exactly what you would want people to do, would be to defend themselves in their homes.
Yes.
Right?
I think so.
I mean, if you're intellectually honest, you would.
But even like if you were woken up out of a dead sleep, whether they said police or not, there's some amount of time from waking up out of a dead sleep. There's no cognitive processing going on there of whether they said police or not. If they came in, now all you hear is them in, stomping feet, moving around and whatnot. Now you know that you have a threat inside your house. You didn't hear them say police when they knocked on the door and opened it up originally. You just know someone busted in your door and you heard a loud noise.
I agree with that. But now, like I say, this witness is magically remembering that they did say police when initially the witness said that they didn't say police. So that's very, very, very critical, because if they're going to believe that story that there was an announcement, and decide that there's no charges based on the fact that the police did announce themselves, then I would like you, Mr. Law Enforcement Apparatus, to give the exact same consideration when someone has a change of memory when it relates to a conviction. That's my whole point of the thing. That's where I'm going with this. We deem you uncredible when you come in and change your story. Magically now, since the story suits the law enforcement apparatus, it is being given more credibility. And I don't understand. I'm a big one about consistency. And there doesn't seem to be any here.
You and your silly terms like consistency, Larry. What am I going to do with you?
It's ridiculous, isn't it?
It is. We have an article over at Collateral Consequences Resource Center. We get articles from here. They're usually pretty interesting. But this one is about Michigan to be the sixth state with automatic conviction relief. This is, I don't want to say it's narrowly tailored, but it is, it's not everybody. It's not PFRs that would get any kind of relief. But there are only a handful of states where after X amount of time, you just fall off the list. Your records are sealed and... Does that mean like you are, I want to be careful how I word this, but just like tongue in cheek, like you are no longer a felon at all? Like your record is clean from a cursory glance of your past, Larry?
It looks like that's what it would mean if I understood it. They have a set aside process in Michigan where the person can be granted that status by the court, but apparently this is going to be an automatic set aside after a period of time. And with those set asides, that was if the conviction never happened. Now, there's still going to be stuff in the law enforcement database about you, but supposedly it protects you from the public humiliation of that prior mistake because it shields that record when that conviction is set aside. That's the best I understood it.
About maybe the second section in, it says, under current Michigan law, eligibility for expungement is quite restrictive. A person may seek expungement either for a single felony conviction as long as the person has no more than two misdemeanors or for no more than two misdemeanors. The person whose felony is set aside thus cannot seek set aside for their misdemeanors, blah, blah, blah. So is set aside like a common term for legal or law for records keeping like that?
It's not something that's in my jargon here in my state, but I'm familiar with it in Michigan because of a case that came to our attention with Zach Anderson.
Okay.
And but yeah, it's not a widely known thing to me anyway.
I was talking to Josh Ho from the Decarceration Nation podcast not too long ago about this. It was like a big deal coming down the pike of getting a certain number of people to have immediate sealing of records. That's the best way that I'm going to term it. And he was pretty excited about that this was coming down the path. Just wanted to put it on everyone's radar that Michigan is making some changes.
Well, it hasn't passed yet, to my understanding. This is a proposal, isn't it?
It says it's set to be. It says a series of bills that would dramatically... So, I mean, it says that the bills are headed to Governor Gretchen Whitmer's for signature. I'm assuming then that means it's passed.
Okay, well then it has passed. Okay. Well, then that would be fantastic. I had, there's a whole list of bills that are apparently headed to the governor.
Very good.
So this would be an instance of bipartisan cooperation because Michigan has split government. I do believe the legislature is still under Republican control. And therefore this means that it got bipartisan support, which is what we hope. That's really all you can do in the way of criminal justice reform. If you don't have bipartisan support, you're certainly going to be vilified. And even if with bipartisan support, sometimes you still get vilified. But without bipartisan support, you're going to be vilified. There's no doubt.
Right on. This one just showed up in the last. Yeah, this one's dated yesterday. And this is from Reason Magazine. Publishing registered sex offenders' home addresses before Halloween is gratuitous, unethical, and reckless. A petition urges Patch and other news outlets to reconsider the practice. This is, we're ramping up here. So it's October 3rd when we're recording this. And, here in another, 27 days, 28 days, we're going to run into Halloween, which is on a Saturday this year. And Patch, I don't know, why is Patch so hell-bent on doing this? But they, they're very local, hyper-local kind of online outlet. And they post these maps of where all the PFRs live. And parents, keep your kids away from these people because they're terrible, terrible. Like, I don't know why they're on this kick, but with the urging of NARSA, I think that they did this based on a press release that went out. And then Reason picked it up and wrote an article about it, which I think is awesome that Narsal does this, and then that Reason would latch onto it to bring awareness to the silliness that the media will portray for all the PFRs during the Halloween time frame.
Absolutely. Shout out goes to the Narsal team, Sandy, and I think Connecticut was involved in it with One Standard of Justice, and this is fantastic work, and thank you.
Yeah, and there's five bullet points that are. I was actually having a conversation with someone recently, and I wanted to bring up this one. It says the vast majority of sexual abused minors, 93%, according to a 2000 BJS, that's the Bureau of Justice Statistics, are assaulted by relatives, family, and friends, or other people they already know. I know you don't want to talk about recidivism and statistics, Larry, but that means that. So 93 out of 100 times, the person is already known and not someone that's on the registry, most likely.
That would be correct.
And that.
But yeah, that was like a well over 100, 150. I don't remember the total number of signatures to this, but it was a phenomenal cross-section of advocates that signed on.
Yeah, they listed a whole bunch. So Lenore Scanese is a very popular lady. Yeah, there's a whole list at the bottom of the article. Even Fred Berlin was at the did a presentation at the Narsal conference this year. And several others, and super awesome article. And Reason is a really neat publication to me because when I first started reading it, I was so confused about like, are they left? Are they right? I was just absolutely baffled because I'd never heard of libertarian before when I'd left. And they, I don't know. I really like their publication, and they provide an interesting balance to what you would hear from a left or right leaning publication.
So, well, fantastic.
And our final.
Great job, Narsal.
Yeah, I like it. And our final article is a correction. This is from Vice News. A correction officer who called the inmate the N-word is getting fired for the third time. That is fired for the third time. A deputy in the same Georgia county was fired after video of him repeatedly punching a black man pinned to the ground went viral. Now, why are we covering this, Larry?
I couldn't help myself because it's from my old stomping grounds of Georgia, and we talked about the need for a law enforcement registry so that it would make it more likely that an officer could jump around and inflict improper behavior unbeknownst. But this officer, if, let's set it up properly, the counties we're talking about are Clayton and Coweta in Georgia, and they're not adjoining, but they're not very far apart either. And Clayton is more of a suburban Atlanta, and then Coweta is a little bit further to the southwest. But after being fired from Coweta, they go to work for the person goes to work for Clayton, gets fired at Clayton, and then is rehired by Clayton. Now, it would be hard to imagine and conceive of Clayton not knowing that he had been fired previously, since they were the ones that fired him. So I'm not sure a registry would prevent that if agencies are willing to rehire people who have been bad officers. I don't know what you do about that. But the only thing that I didn't have the ability to figure out is if the firing occurred because of the change of administrations and the rehiring. I'm not clear on the timeline because Sheriff Victor Hill, who's been sheriff twice now, he ended up leaving office because of his own criminal problems, and he was acquitted, and he got elected again. I'm not sure if Victor was the firer or the rehirer, but it's just ironic that a person can be fired three times. At some point, law enforcement, if you're listening in Georgia, don't hire this officer again. He's not appropriate for police work. Let him find something else to do.
He may need to find something else. I highlighted here the racist incident will mark the third time this individual has been fired from a corrections job in a decade. Like, come on, man. We could probably do better, but I don't know that we could do better, Larry. Like, the people that are working in as correction officers, it's not that NASA had stopped hiring, so this was their second choice.
No, it's one of those jokes I make when people are talking about what they want to be in their career. I have never heard anybody say, Mom, I can't wait. When I get out of college, I'm going to go to work in a prison or correctional facility. I don't think I've ever heard that. I have heard people say they want to be juvenile probation officers and work in juvenile justice, but I have never heard someone in my 164 years of life say that they wanted to work in an adult correctional facility yet. That was their first choice of work.
Larry, joining us right now is our guest for the evening. It's Dr. Christopher Pulaski. And Dr. Pulaski earned his medical degree from Northwestern University Medical School in Chicago in 2001 and was accepted into the Radiation Oncology Residency Training Program at the University of Texas Medical Division. Is that right? Medical Division?
MD Anderson.
Yeah, okay. So yeah. MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, and served on the faculty there and the Ohio State University Comprehensive Cancer Center. He ran his own full clinical practice, supervised his own basic science research laboratory, and served as the OSU department's residency program director and as the director of pediatric radiation oncology. Chris is a survivor of childhood sexual abuse and subsequently suffered throughout most of his life with undiagnosed and untreated post-traumatic stress disorder with dissociated features. After a federal CP conviction, he was sentenced to the Federal Correction Institution Elkton, then a halfway house, and he completed supervision and probation in July of 2020. Dr. Pulaski has received numerous literary rewards for both his books about his experience in the criminal justice system and hopes to be a strong advocate for change in social policies and a better understanding of mental health issues. First and foremost, we invited Dr. Pulaski to examine a recent story aired by NPR on August 25th, 2020. There was a follow-up piece on September 8th about the pandemic loosening in-person registration. There will be a link in the show notes to the article. And the point is, the story was not presented fairly, and Dr. Pulaski reached out to NPR management. In addition to the matter with NPR, we will talk about his books a little bit later in the interview. Welcome, 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 Dr. Pulaski. Welcome.
Well, thank you for having me on. I'm a big fan, long-time listener of the show, and I'm pretty honored that you guys would have me on here. So thank you.
Appreciate it. Larry, you got a whole battery of questions to go over about this this whole thing from NPR.
I do, and thank you for being patient with us, because we actually had this on the agenda for several weeks, and then we ended up not doing it because other things were breaking, and thought they were this is press inaccurate reporting, and this is an ongoing thing where there was no real urgency. And in fact, I thought maybe we'll give NPR management a chance to respond. But we appreciate your patience and the fact that you're still willing to join us after waiting a month or however long it was. So thank you for being with us.
That's no problem.
So you've touched on an issue that's very important to me in terms of accuracy in reporting and what we can do about it as a society. And you wrote to NPR. What prompted you to write to National Public Radio about your concerns?
Well, you know, I was driving home from work. I think it was a Tuesday afternoon, August 25th, and I hear this story about, you know, the sex offender registry on NPR. And, you know, I was a pretty regular listener of NPR. You know, they don't yell at each other. They don't have all these talking heads on there. So I'm like, oh, okay, they're going to discuss maybe some nuances, some info. And I'm listening. And, you know, their main thrust was that there are a lot of people that go, the whereabouts are unknown, or they're not registering, you know, they're not in compliance. And then they use the term absconded. You know, they said there's thousands of them and we should all be scared. And then, you know, she's going through some of these very disturbing cases. And as I'm listening to this, I'm like, this is NPR. And it feels like I'm listening to some like local news network, getting the listeners and the neighborhood all scared. And I was so disappointed. It just stuck in my head. And so the next day, I just kind of wrote out this letter, and I sent it to the reporter, Cheryl Thompson, as well as the All Things Considered senior editor. Let's see, it's Courtney Dorning. Never heard back, but I just kind of just let it all out there, how disappointed I was in the type of reporting. And, you know, she made this argument that there's thousands of registrants and their whereabouts are unknown and we should all be scared. then later on, she kind of says, well, the only time these absconded registrants are apprehended is when they have run-ins with the law. And what was interesting is she kind of missed the whole point there, is that there's thousands of people that aren't compliant, and they're only sort of discovered when they get in trouble with the law. Well, that means there's thousands of registrants that are really not causing any trouble, who have moved on in their lives and doing well. And that entire point was just missed. And instead, they focused on some of the scary and extreme cases, but those were individual cases, you know, really not looking at the population or the bigger picture. And it was pretty maddening to listen to and to see that even within their own data that they're presenting, they're missing sort of that obvious point, you know. And they say, oh, well, the, you know, law enforcement isn't out looking for these people and trying to find them. And I would argue it's like, well, because a lot of law enforcement knows that it's not worth the time and energy because they're not the ones causing problems. They have a finite amount of resources, you know, and it just struck a nerve. And I, you know, before I sent it, I shared it with Sandy Rosick of NARSOL, and she ended up posting that letter on the NARSOL website. And, you know, and I've never heard back from either the reporter or the editor of All Things Considered, and they've even run another segment. And some parts of that, they're kind of acting like vigilantes, because they were hunting people down and saying, hey, you know, go look for this guy. We found him, policeman. And it was just really disheartening. You know, I haven't really listened to NPR since.
So
because
let's move on to the next question. Now we all know that people on the registry do have various issues with compliance. And my point that I raise is that people are often non-compliant because they've built the compliance to be so strenuously tedious that it's easy to be non-compliant. And then they say, I got you here. You didn't make it in within 24 hours of some key change that you had. So we got you. And right. NPR, if they're doing the balanced reporting that we expect of them, do you believe that they truly don't know that the registry is an addition to what they think of the person who goes out and snatches a child off the street, which that's the stereotypical person, or the rapist? Do they not know that the registry is filled with people who've had consensual sex because there's only a slight difference in age that might make it illegal? In some states, there could be a matter of days difference. If someone is slightly under 18, there could be for indecent exposure, which we would call streaking. Do they not know those things, or do they not care?
I think they definitely know. I mean, you don't have to go digging very deeply to know these things about the registry and who can end up on it. You really don't have to do much investigating to see the low recidivism rates. And I don't think they purposefully ignored that because they don't want to upset their listeners and their sponsors.
Well, wait a minute. But now this is what we expect from commercial journalism, where profit is the motive. Are you telling me that NPR would contradict science because of financial reasons? Are they no different than CNN and Fox and all the other the commercial broadcasting? That's really disturbing. Is that what you're saying?
That is what I'm saying. You know, I was kind of under that impression too, like they're this unbiased arbiter of information, and but no, they're beholden to sponsorship dollars. You know, I thought the bulk of their funding came from Congress or the federal or state governments, but the bulk comes from individual donations and corporate sponsorship. I mean, that accounts for almost 60%. And so if you're going to go out and, you know, put out pieces that look remotely in favor of, you know, sex offender law reform, or, hey, maybe we should look at this differently, there's that fear that you're going to lose lose your listeners and lose your sponsorship. So I think they're just as beholden to, you know, dollars as CNN and Fox are. And anytime you have dollars attached to a news entity's existence, that's going to affect the content. And I think that's what's happened with this NPR piece.
Well, you provided us with a pie chart of their funding. I think we're going to make, Randy, we can make that available, can't we? Did you want to just hit the high parts of where their funding comes from? Because I don't want to minimize the importance of funding, whether you're whether you're NPR or whether you're a commercial broadcast entity. You have costs that you have to cover. You have personnel. You have assistants. You have all sorts of costs related to being on the air. But if we talk about where their funding comes from, and they have to be beholden to their funding, then what would the answer be if we truly want journalistic practices that don't ignore science? What would some options be? Because we don't want to use public dollars. That's only like, I think, would the pie chart show like 8% or something of their funding? What would be an alternative if we can't use public dollars and they can't be beholden to their sponsors and their donors? What would we do?
Well, for me personally, I've sort of entered into this world of podcasts, and you know, because I was on, I came off of supervision only as recently as the end of July, and so I didn't have a smartphone, and but I've started listening to various podcasts, and I'm now under this feeling that podcasts are like the last bastion of true unbiased journalism.
Wait a minute, can you talk about podcasts for a second? I've never heard of this. Tell me about this real quick.
Yeah. No, exactly. I've listened to your podcast, a few others that really get to an issue, really get the details that you would never get from really any source at this point. Everything has to be very brief. But I think these podcasts allow you to really get down, you know, into the reeds and really see what's going on.
Yeah. They let you get hyper targeted to a niche, into a very, very focused specific area.
Yeah. I think a lot of these, the grassroots efforts and, you know, organizations like NARSOL, where, you know, your content isn't dictated by your sponsorship. You know, I understand there is a business, like, to get your to do programming. It does cost money, but I just feel like, it's in even prior to this experience with NPR was like my last chance or my last hope to get what I thought was unbiased news. But now I just don't know what to do, because anytime there's an event, I'll try to get news from multiple sources, and sometimes I'm like, is this covering the same event? Like, it's just really bad, and I feel like that really hurts the sex offender law reform effort, because it's like everyone knows all this stuff, but everyone's afraid to say it. It's really, I don't know, it's very frustrating.
Well, we covered what I had on my mind, and you've written some books, and we wanted to give you an opportunity to talk a little bit about your books. And so you've written more than one book. Tell us why you wrote the books, and let's have you plug your books, because we have tens of thousands of people listening, ready to purchase these books.
Yeah. Well, you know, the first book was just, it's called Drama, Shame, and the Power of Love. And that really focused more on my journaling, going through my abuse therapy, and you know, I showed it to some friends and colleagues, and they're like, well, hey, you should you know, this could help a lot of people. You should publish it. And, you know, maybe one day when your kids are old enough, they can kind of read and understand what was going on. And what was also interesting is one colleague who really helped me get it published quickly said, well, you know, maybe the medical board can read, you know, what actually happened. Maybe they'll have a better understanding, because the local news media certainly didn't do any favors at all. And so I did that. And of course that didn't matter. The local news were there to put the heat on the medical board, and the cameras were rolling, and you know, the board cited incorrect and inaccurate information from the news when everything started. And so that was kind of the first book. The second book is A Tortuous Path, and I really wasn't going to write a second one, but after going to prison and meeting a lot of the people that were in there with me and going through the post-incarceration experience, I'm like, again, I have to, I almost feel like the story, everyone's story kind of needs to get out. There needs to be some type of counter narrative to what the news and what passes for journalism now is going on. So that's kind of those are the reasons why I wrote these books.
And one more time, give the title of both, and are they available out there for our listeners?
Yeah, they're both. There's a print, you know, like a paperback, and an ebook version. It's on Amazon. And the first book is Trauma, Shame, and the Power of Love, and the subtitle is The Fall and Rise of a Physician Who Heals Himself. Kind of a mouthful. And then the second book is A Tortuous Path, Atonement and Reinvention in a Broken System. And they're both available on Amazon.
And
surprisingly, they've won some awards, which I take that as a good sign that sort of the uninitiated people who don't know me would read it and learn a lot from it and put their name to it by giving it an award. So you know, that's one of the goals, is try to inform the general public, people who may not even be aware of what the sex offense laws are all about, to at least think about it. Even if they don't agree with me, at least they're considering it.
Well, I'm going to wrap up with one question, then hand it off to Andy. How has your understanding of the sex offense laws evolved? I mean, compare where you were before you encountered the system to where you are now, and what's transpired in that intervening educational experience?
Educational is an understatement there, but you know, I kind of grew up with that misinformation. You know, the frighteningly high rate of reoffending and recidivism brought up by, you know, Justice Kennedy, that kind of became instant fact. And, you know, and I was a victim of, you know, childhood sexual abuse. And so I think I had like this, I don't know how to describe it, but I was kind of down on contact offenders, and I was very defensive, like, well, I didn't do that, this was done to me, blah, blah, blah. But as time goes on, I've realized that no matter what the sex offense was, the likelihood people are going to do that again is very low. The likelihood of them having prior convictions is very low. And just the overkill, the whole approach to how sex offender laws are dealt with, it's assuming everyone is like the evil, relentless, remorseless monster. And regardless of what the offense is, that's not the case. And I've, you know, over time, I've forgiven the people who abused me and realized, you know, they were probably suffering in some way or another as well. And, you know, it's kind of, I've kind of gone through this learning process, and I've had to go through the legal system and have this like personal catastrophe happen for me to kind of open my eyes. So I'm aware of how difficult it is for other people who don't have that experience to kind of see the other side. And that's where I'm hoping like my books can come in and kind of fill in those gaps.
Well, we are very delighted to have you here. And you indicated you wanted to be more of an advocate, and there is plenty of an ample opportunity for you to do more in the way of advocacy from anything yeah. from legislative advocacy to writing, to speaking. I mean, it's out there, and your credentials would be impressive. I would think anyway, maybe they'll go down the crapper after you have a conviction, but I would think that your lifetime achievement should not be negated by this one mistake.
Yeah. And I have, you know, started to get more involved. I'm a contributing author now for Narsal. I had my first article out, in the, Narsal Digest. I'm getting involved with other types of writing, but yeah, I think, you know, starting to speak more and get involved in the more the legislative process, I think that's on the horizon. But you know, I've only been out of supervision for a few months, so it's probably going to take me a little while.
Well, welcome to the cause of advocacy, and thank you for joining us. And Andy, did you have anything else?
I really like the question you asked about the change of mind from before and after. I thought was an incredibly good question to ask. But also that when you do listen to podcasts, like you are self-selecting yourself into a filter bubble of sorts. And unless you're like the anti-registrant person to listen to this podcast, mm-hmm. to try and like the people that listen to this podcast generally are already in our camp. So we're preaching to the choir, so to speak. That's really right. All I wanted to add to the podcast movement thing.
Right. And that is one thing, I want to avoid the echo chamber effect in my work as well. And in some ways, that's kind of what NPR was doing, too, you know, being an echo chamber.
Well, again, thank you so much for joining us. That is we really, really appreciate you having you on. And again, welcome to the advocacy movement.
Thank you very much. And like I said, I love the work you guys do.
Thank you.
And thank you for
becoming a patron too.
Yeah.
Yeah. He came in at $1,200 a month.
Absolutely. Couldn't do it without you.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, mortgage rates are low nowadays. So.
That's a joke we have about the stimulus payment, where we were asking someone to make their entire stimulus payment, but no one's taken us up on that yet. So thank you, sir. Good night.
Good night.
Bye. That wraps it up. Bye-bye. Man, we finished it all. I'm surprised that we got all that in. I was trying to dump articles, and you said, no, we can do it. Just keep it short.
And we did.
We did. All right, so now we're going to announce some new patrons. Nate, who is an existing patron and has been for quite some time, he has increased his contribution. Thank you so very much. And we got a new patron named Michael, and a super extra special thank you goes to Anna with a very generous contribution. Thank you to all of our listeners and especially our patrons. Thanks, guys, very much. Appreciate it.
And how do people contact the program?
They do it by turning on their computer, and preferably your monitor also, because it's hard to use it without seeing it. And you navigate your way using Netscape Navigator, and you wait for your modem to dial into America Online, and you wait to the little noises, and you go to registrymatters.co.
Okay, and then if they want to leave a voicemail, which we haven't had any recently that I can think of, how would they do that?
They would pick up their phone, and so there's the rotary thing. So it would go 747-227-4477. Do you remember those days of rotary?
I do indeed. And what about if they want to contact us by electronic message?
They would go to registrymatterscast@gmail.com.
And what's the best way of all that you could show your love for the Registry Matters podcast?
Send blank checks to 123 Main Street, in there was always like a certain town that they would use, like in Colorado. It was like Pueblo, Colorado. That was where you would always send in like the sweepstakes forms. But go to patreon.com/registrymatters, and it is incredibly endearing and humbling that we have so many people that support us. And I thank each and every one of you. I really appreciate it.
And that's the best way. And you can do that for as little as $1 and any amount I think you want. It's free form. You can do whatever you want, right?
Yeah, I mean, $1 is the minimum, but you could certainly make it the maximum that you'd like to do.
So, and we're looking for $1,000 a month from somebody, Larry, from one person.
It could happen at some point. Larry, I so very much appreciate having you here, and I look forward to having you here again.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
That is why I am here.
Did I do it right this time?
We're getting closer.
All right, it's because I got a button this time. Thanks, guys, very much for joining us. Larry, as always, thank you, and I hope that everyone has a great rest of your weekend, and we will talk to you soon.
Good night.
You've been listening to FYP.